Reynolds Journalism Institute at the University of Missouri. Welcome to Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. On Sunday, people in Turkey will go to the polls to elect the 550 members of the country's National Assembly. The vote follows an election in June in which no party won a majority and efforts to form a coalition government broke down shortly afterwards. This upcoming election is viewed as a referendum on President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, whose popularity has steadily dropped in recent months. Erdogan has been Turkey's dominant political figure since becoming prime minister in 2003, but he faces political troubles as fighting between the government and Kurdish rebels has resumed in southeastern Turkey. Meanwhile, the country is struggling to contain the spillover from the wars in Syria and Iraq, and Turkey's once roaring economic growth has slowed. One way Erdogan has tried to alleviate his political problems is by silencing his critics. Earlier this week, police raided two opposition television stations, forcing them off the air. His government has censored news coverage of a major terrorist bombing in the capital Ankara earlier this month and has routinely blocked access to social media sites. Harassment and prosecution of critical journalists has become nearly routine, and in recent months, three foreign journalists have been expelled. We'll discuss Turkey's upcoming election in just a few minutes, but first we're going to hear more about its worsening media climate. Joining us now from New York City is Karin Deutsch-Karlicker, director of the PEN America Center's Free Expression Program and a former director of Freedom House's Freedom of the Press Project. Karin Deutsch-Karlicker, thanks for joining us. We did hear about this alarming attack on two opposition media stations, I should say this raid on two opposition media stations just this week. It seems a very odd thing to happen just in the days before a national election.
Yeah, well, I mean, the world's attention is on Turkey right now, and so one would expect, you know, that the government would not be doing something so egregious in the days leading up to an election. And I think it's really an indication of the, you know, the fear that, that Erdogan has about the election results. This is a, you know, an opposition media group which has a, you know, major daily newspaper, several TV stations, a radio station, and it is one of the, you know, more critical voices left in Turkey. So it's surprising to me that he would do this right before an election, but I think it does follow a pattern that we've seen in recent months of crackdowns on any type of opposition or critical voices in the media sphere.
And this was nominally done because of a tax investigation or an accounting investigation. It wasn't. The government isn't saying that this is a political raid. Is that correct?
No, I mean, of course it wouldn't, but the Turkish government is known and has a history of using sort of economic investigations, tax or business investigations against critical media outlets, and this has been going on, you know, at least for the last 10 years. There was the major investigation against the Dogan Media Group a number of years ago. So this does follow a pattern, and it seems like they didn't actually even really find anything during the investigations that they could try and charge, you know, the editors or the owners of the outlets with, or the media groups, so then they resorted to the actual raid and the closure of the TV stations and basically replacing news programming with you know, documentaries about camels, which is...
And place this in context, if you would, though. You know, it does seem like there was a turning point for the Turkish media was these big protests in Istanbul's Gezi Park back in 2013. What has happened since then? How has the government's relationship with the media changed?
I would say it's become even more polarized. I mean, that was the beginning of that year really saw the beginning of a real backsliding in media freedom in Turkey. For example, that was the year that, when I was still working at Freedom House, we started rating the Turkish media not free based on those events. And there are dozens of columnists and journalists being fired. There are restrictions on content. There were these overt censorship. We're basically breaking into news outlets and replacing programming. So that trend has only continued and I think worsened. So this does form part of a larger pattern. But the whole media environment has become, I would say, much more polarized since that point.
And what about the government's regulation of social media? What has its relationship been like with Twitter, Facebook, Google, and the people who use them?
Yeah, no, I mean, they've been cracking down on social media as well. I mean, that's really one of the last openings in Turkey, particularly on Twitter. And so you've seen now cases against journalists and other ordinary users for tweets that are, you know, deemed insulting to Erdogan. You've seen shutdowns of the entire platforms, requests for takedowns of content. The Turkish government is one of the leading governments requesting Twitter for takedowns of content and Facebook as well. So they've really gone after all media platforms from a traditional media media to the increasingly important social media.
And what about its relationship with foreign correspondents, with international correspondents? I did see a quote recently from Turkey's culture minister saying the country was at war with, quote, Reuters, BBC, CNN, the German newspaper Der Spiegel. He compared this war to the Battle of Gallipoli, which was, of course, a World War I battle in which the Ottomans defeated the British. Tell us about that.
I mean, I would say it's a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, basically, you know, many of these outlets have correspondents in Turkey, you know, both to cover Turkish politics, but also the increasingly important role that Turkey is playing, you know, in the war with you know, going on in Syria, with ISIS, with what's going on in the border, with the refugee crisis. So, you know, Turkey's really at a crux in terms of world politics, and it's entirely rational that foreign, you know, news outlets would want to have correspondents there to cover, you know, major stories coming out of Turkey for the world audience, not just, you know, Turkish politics as well. So it's, you know, there always have been a lot of correspondents based in Turkey, and there has been this really, you know, alarming crackdown again over the last 2 years, where we've seen a number of correspondents either expelled or harassed or subject to sort of online threats, particularly female correspondents. So that is also definitely part of a trend, and it's, you know, it's another thing that's really restricting the news, both coming out of Turkey, but also that Turks are able to access themselves.
And Turkey has received a lot of criticism for this from press freedom groups, human rights groups, to some extent from other governments. Has that had any effect?
Not as much as I've seen. I mean, the government, you know, has a lot of bravado and really talks back quite extensively, or then tries to sort of, you know, cast spurious allegations on the intentions of these human rights and press freedom groups. And I found that at Freedom House, where I personally and our president were getting maligned in the Turkish pro-government press after we came out with this analysis. But the analysis is clear, and all the groups agree. The OSCE Special Rapporteur agrees, the EU agrees. I mean, there's really no disagreement on all the groups that follow the situation about what the, you know, what's going on the ground. And that's a severe deterioration of press freedom and media freedom and broader freedom of expression in Turkey right now.
Karen Deutsch-Karlicker, thanks so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. Today, I look at the upcoming elections in Turkey and whether one of the Islamic world's most vibrant democracies is under threat. Joining us now to discuss the vote in Turkey and the country's recent challenges, from Los Angeles, Pinar Tremblay, a columnist for Al Monitor's Turkey Pulse. From Ankara, Turkey, Suat Kanikilioglu, a former member of parliament for the ruling AK Party. He's now a columnist for the opposition newspaper Today Zemin and director of a Turkish think tank called the Center for Strategic Communication. And from Istanbul, Berkay Mandaraci, a researcher in International Crisis Group's Istanbul office. Welcome to all of you. Suat Kanikilioglu, Turkey is just days away from having snap elections. Correct me if I'm wrong, I believe this is the fourth election in 2 years. How important could this election possibly be, given that Turkey seems to keep having elections over and over again?
Indeed, this is the fourth election in 2 years, but it is an extremely important election because the country has been really in a state of anomaly since the Gezi Park protests in 2013. And the growing authoritarianism that we see in Turkey has not been resolved in the last three elections. And this is a repeat election of the one in June because the president basically prevented the formation of the coalition and exploited some of the constitution that allowed him to push for another election. So it's extremely important. Given how much institutions are hollowed out, the judiciary, the media, the civil society, businesses, so the only credible and legitimate force left to make a democratic correction is really the Turkish electorate, and that's what we're going to see hopefully on Sunday.
Berkay Mandaraci, you're in Istanbul. Tell us what the mood is like there. It sounds like it has been a rather bitter campaign, and there does seem to be sort of a rising level of violence in Turkey. There was this major terrorist attack earlier this month. There is a renewed fighting between the government and Kurds. How do people on the street feel?
Well, definitely. I mean, since the 7 June elections and after the 20 July Suruç attack, we've been tracking the numbers of human beings killed in the PKK, flared up PKK and Turkey conflict. And we've seen that so far...
The PKK being the Kurdish separatists.
Exactly. So the Kurdish insurgency and the conflict between the Kurdish insurgency and the Turkish state, and also combining the numbers that the casualties that we've seen in the Islamic State attacks, we have around 510 casualties since 20 July. So for in 100 days, 510 people have been killed in this country. This makes 5 people per day. So you can imagine in what kind of a traumatic atmosphere these elections are going to take
place. So basically 5 people a day killed in political violence then.
Exactly. So this has caused some traumatic atmosphere in the country. And all these attacks and this violence, what we are also observing is that people are getting even more consolidated within the political parties, and the cleavage between the political parties is even deepening. And Turkey has been polarized in the last years a lot, and the violence that especially surged after the Suruç attack, which was on the border region of Turkey, has consolidated people even further in the political fractions, and it has definitely increased polarization in Turkey.
Pinar Tremblay in Los Angeles. You know, during the last elections, no party won a majority, and so the AK Party wasn't able to form a government with another coalition. There is a sense that Turkey's coming apart a bit at the seams right now. Is this sort of like the inevitable outcome of the last election, or why is this violence occurring now?
Well, there are different theories about why the violence is occurring. One of the reasons is said to be that AKP made some promises that we're not quite sure what they are to the Kurds, and they have not been realized. At least that's what the Kurds are saying. They're saying we've been very patient, and we have not received what was promised for us. So that's one of the reasons. The second reason is the fact that it seems the more introvert Turkey will go, the more AKP government will win. That is, if they keep losing domestically on the ballot box, which they have been blessed to win for a while, but if they keep losing, and they know the trend is that they're going to be losing because they're losing the youth vote. And that is very, very critical considering the fact that since the presidential elections, over 1,300,000 first-time voters have been in the election. On the ballot box. That's a huge number. And AKP is losing a significant portion of the younger population despite all the wild promises. So they have to, make rally around the flag, get on board with us.
Suat Kınıklıoğlu, one of the interesting figures in this election is someone who's not on the ballot, and that's this cleric named Fethullah Gulen, who lives in the U.S. in Pennsylvania. The government accuses him of operating something like a shadow state in Turkey. Now, you write for one of the Gulen movement's newspapers. Tell us just a bit about the movement and what its role is in this election.
The Gulen movement is a large international structure consisting of schools, media outlets, and it was until 2010 and 11 in alliance with the ruling party. In 2010-11, there was a breakup between them, and since then, there is a strong reaction by the government limiting their actions, including their schools, and as we saw yesterday and the day before, using what appears to be legal measures, but pretty much aimed at preventing criticism coming at the government through their media outlets. So we see a tug of war between them.
Because this media, these two TV stations that were raided this week were also part of a company affiliated with the Gulen movement. Is that not correct?
Well, not officially, but it was the owner has been publicly out saying that he respects Mr. Gulen a lot. So that, it was pretty close to the movement, maybe not organically, but pretty much the voice, the broadcasting policy was very critical of the government. And the importance of those channels was that Turkey's conservatives were watching these things. So this was a clientele that was important for the government. And now they're silenced, unfortunately. So opposition views all opposition parties have actually difficulty in reaching out to the electorate in what is probably one of the most critical elections in Turkish Republican history.
And Berke Menderaci, You know, another sort of compelling force, compelling figure in this election has been the rise of this pro-Kurdish leftist party, the HDP. They won 13% of the electorate in June, which was a high figure for them. What is this party for? Why did they sort of succeed in garnering so much support last time around?
Well, I mean, the HDP emerged as a party representing different wings of the Kurdish people in Turkey. Actually, they were also able to appeal to conservative Kurds, for example, in the 7 June elections, which used to vote, who used to vote for the AKP predominantly. And this party came also forward with a pluralist discourse and also appealed to the liberal segments of Turkish society. And, I mean, we as crisis group after the 7 June elections were actually also quite hopeful, you know, for because the HDP was able to enter the parliament with a surprising percentage. And we thought that this would bring the peace process also on a better footing, because the peace process was already quite, at that time, was already nearly derailed. So they were dangerous for the process to break down. So that kind of seemed as an opportunity for Turkey to bring the peace process to a successful point. However, this did not materialize. And now we are seeing a phenomenon, especially in the southeast of the country, in the predominantly Kurdish areas, where the AKP is directly in a rivalry with the ruling government, is directly in a rivalry with the HDP. And what is crucial for Turkey is to bring back the peace process on track. But now with this new internal dynamic where the two parties are directly rivaling each other, there needs to be a new format. And that is, I think, the main challenge that is awaiting us after these elections. And we need a politically conducive environment to be able to find out what this new format can be about to bring the peace process back on track.
And Pinar Tremblay, if you could pick up on that, we have seen that the Turkish military has cordoned off entire towns in parts of southeast Turkey to shell them with artillery. What prospects are there for peace between the PKK, the Kurdish guerrillas, and the government after the elections? Is there a clear outcome that could lead to peace?
Well, yes and no. If HDP cannot make it into the parliament, which is not going to happen because they are going to make it, it looks like, unless something goes drastically wrong, AKP might be willing to reconsider, you know, as long as they're in charge of the peace process and they're in charge of the Kurds. That's scenario one, one aspect of it. The second one is what's happening with Islamic State in Syria and how the Kurdish forces down there are going to lead. Because AKP is very, very concerned that Kurds are going to be occupying the whole southeastern border with Syria. Instead of Syria, now we're seeing a Kurdish state, just like we're seeing one in Iraq. So they are concerned about that. They want the Americans to pressure the Kurds to go into Raqqa and not to take over all the places on the border of Turkey and former Syria. So if Kurds, which they signaled yesterday, Demirtas said the Kurdish forces are going to be taking over on the border. So if Kurds keep up with that, Turkish government keeps saying that's their red line. I don't know if that would make things worse. But the people of the region definitely want peace. And I agree with all the commentators that, you know, there is going to be hope if something could change in the parliament and other parties could get together and do something. But again, the hopes for that is very low as well.
This is Global Journalist. I'm Jason McClure. This week, a look at Turkey's upcoming elections and what the results could mean in a country in a volatile region. Joining us this week from Los Angeles, Pinar Tremblay, a columnist for the news site Al Monitor's Turkey Pulse. From Ankara, Turkey, Suat Kınıklıoğlu, a columnist for the opposition newspaper Today's Zemin. And from Istanbul, Berkay Mendoraci, a researcher for International Crisis Group. A reminder that if you're interested in more Global Journalist content, visit us online at globaljournalist.org. There you can read in-depth articles on international affairs and free press issues and download past episodes from our archive. We're also on social media. You can like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Global Jern. Suat Kanıklıoğlu, one of President Erdogan's goals during the last campaign was to change the constitution to give him more power. He needed a large majority for his AK Party in parliament to do that. Do you still see that that's the goal for him, is to change the constitution to give himself more authority?
No, I think he realizes that it's not possible. His game plan is very much to secure a majority for the Justice and Development Party and de facto rule Turkey through an executive presidency, as there was likely to be very little resistance to that from the party. He dominates the party quite strongly.
Well, Berke Menderaci, let me take you back to what Pinar Tremblay was saying about the role of the conflict in Syria here. Turkey's foreign relations are quite complex and intertwined, with its domestic politics. You know, the U.S. has been backing the Kurds in Iraq, in Syria. Obviously, Turkey views the Kurds as a threat, but the U.S. and Turkey are NATO allies. Where do you see things going between the two countries? What does Turkey need from the U.S. right now?
Well, Turkey's position with regard to Syria is, of course, a very complicated one at the moment. And it's, I would say, its hands also in Syria are quite weakened due to not very wise foreign policy decisions. And, I mean, what the flare-up between the PKK and Turkey is also an extension of what happened in Syria. But there are two sides to the story, I would say, because the PKK's legitimacy, international legitimacy, overall also increased. I mean, we are in a different situation at the moment compared to when actually the negotiations between PKK and Turkey started, which was around 2012. The PKK is a regional power which is getting support from the West, and its legitimacy has also increased. Many people also, I was in Diyarbakir last week, are also saying, you know, that this was kind of seen by the PKK as a window of opportunity to exert its force more harshly also on Turkey. That's why the regional dimension, we see kind of a regionalization of this conflict, and it will not be possible to go back to the negotiating table now with the conditions that were existing before the Syria issue. I think this regional international dimension is going to play a very crucial role to be able to go back on the negotiating table, and the Turkish government has to take this into account as well.
Pinar Tremblay, the elections on Sunday, with regard to them, is there any concern about the legitimacy or fairness of the balloting procedures that are going to take place?
Well, the last election was fairly better reviewed with regards to ballot safety. I think people have become extremely conscious from all schools of beliefs and political parties. I do have some concerns with regards to the southeastern and central Anatolian votes, because there are areas where a couple of hundreds of votes could make a serious effect on the final result, the way that the redistricting gerrymandering has been done in Turkey. So we have to watch these areas very carefully, yes.
And Suat Kanıklıoğlu, Turkey has had, I believe it's 5 coups since World War II, roughly one every decade. Is there still the threat of a military coup in Turkey if we see sort of continued political instability there?
I doubt that. The military has learned from its mistakes in the past. I don't think, unless things get really out of hand and there becomes full chaos in Turkey, that would be the only way where the military would intervene. You know, to our interest, legitimacy still can only be obtained in Turkey through the ballot box. The problem has been, of course, that we didn't have a free and fair election environment, so it's very difficult to gauge what the outcome will be. But it would not be a surprise to me if the ruling party increases its votes by 1 or 2%, because the terror attacks, the aftermath, and how it was spun by and how it was manipulated in the government-dominated media has unfortunately created a situation where many people, perhaps not because they like the party or are happy with the performance, but in the interest of stability and some normality in the economy, may switch back to the ruling party. So I think we should all brace ourselves for a surprise. But as I said, Turkey is going through a very peculiar and unique election environment. I might be proven wrong, and you know, there could be a much worse performance by the ruling party. But I don't see the current polling companies really pinning it down. So we might be in for a surprise in either direction.
Berker Mendiraci, sorry, what's your prediction for this election outcome? Where do you see Turkey being 1 year from now?
I think that, I mean, also looking at the polls at the moment, and also at the ones that are trustable, it seems that there will not be too much of a change. I mean, as the previous speaker just said, I mean, 1 or 2% changes could happen, and it seems very unlikely that the AKP will gain back its single-party majority. But what I mean, if the scenario is this and we end up with a similar result to the 7 June elections, then I think what is crucial for Turkey is to for the parties, especially for the failed AKP-CHP talks, to be taken up from where they actually stop. And I believe that a grand AKP-CHP coalition that is supported by the HDP, which was also declared, is the only way to create a politically conducive environment.
The CHP is the main opposition party in Turkey right now.
Exactly,
so talking about sort of a government of unity.
Republican Party, exactly. So that would be the best possible way of having a conducive political environment. As, I mean, I don't think that this kind of a coalition will last for too long. But even now, I mean, given the violent conflict that is going on in Turkey and the escalation and also the threat of Islamic State on Turkey, I think this would be a politically conducive environment to face those challenges for a short while at least.
And Pinar Tremblay, our time grows short. We do have just about 30 seconds left. Earlier in his tenure as back when he was prime minister, President Erdogan, he'd been seen as sort of a mediator between the West and the Islamic world, you know, sort of a democratic politician who's also a devout Muslim. Is he still viewed that way? Can he play that role again?
I don't think so. I think it's on a steep decline, and Erdogan has lost the trust of the Muslim world and also the trust of the Turkish Islamists. And we can see that from the fact that the more to the right Felicity Party did not join in with AKP. I think that was a huge step that AKP is going to, you know, suffer from.
So, and in other words, the far-right conservative party didn't join his party to form government.
Yeah, and Hudapar this time, they're the Kurdish Islamist party, the Turkish Hezbollah. They're not running this time. So most of them are going to be either voting for the Felicity Party or for HDP. So I don't think AKP's votes are going to increase. I know I'm looking at the polls as well, but I'm going to be the gambling woman on this panel now.
That'll do it for this edition of Global Journalist, a production of the Reynolds Journalism Institute and the Missouri School of Journalism. Many thanks to Karen Deutsch-Karlicker, Pinar Tremblay, Suat Kınıklıoğlu, and Berkay Mendiraci for coming on the program. Global Journalist Executive Producer is Josh Kranzberg. Our associate producers this week are Lakshana Mehta, Nicole Osuna, Colby Satterfield, and Adam Sturrock. Our studio director is Travis McMillan from RJI. Our audio engineer is Pat Akers of KBIA. For all of us at Global Journalist, I'm Jason McClure. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time.